ready to rise above loud, angry headlines, longing for an alternative to the world's fighting and fear-mongering? Christianity Today magazine offers a trustworthy, faithful perspective on stories that matter to you, from the church next door to movements and ministries all around the world. Subscribe to CT for full access to in-depth reporting, insightful commentary, and redemptive storytelling, both online and in print. A subscription to CT also includes seasonal devotionals, special issues, and exclusive content. Visit orderct.com today or click the link in the show notes to get started and join a growing community of thoughtful evangelical Christians who value different news that makes a difference. That's orderct.com to subscribe today.
This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It: Why Jesus Is Your Greatest Hope on Earth and in Eternity, by Phil Robertson. Available now everywhere you get audiobooks.
Hello, this is Russell Moore. You're listening to The Russell Moore Show from Christianity Today. Every week here, we explore conversations and questions from a Christian perspective, and there's a lot of exciting stuff about to be coming out that we'll be talking about a little bit later that I can't talk about quite yet, but be sure to tap the cover art and sign up as a member at Christianity Today. You can do so with a free trial time to do it. But that will make you aware and able to be involved in some really, really cool stuff that I'm almost tempted to start talking about right now, and I'm not supposed to. So we will wait on that. But I am looking forward today to talking to my friend Sam Alberry, who is the author of many books, including most recently What God Has to Say About Our Bodies, and who speaks and preaches and teaches all over the world. And I don't even know why we're doing this this way. We're only a matter of miles separated from each other here in Nashville, so we might as well be in the same room, but we're separated here a little bit by some technology, maybe just because it's so early in the morning as we're doing this. Sam, welcome to the Russell Moore Show.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Sam, the death of the Queen is, of course, a major story all over the world. When I heard of the Queen's death, one of the first things that came to mind for me as an American is the way of one of the most moving things, and I watch it on YouTube quite often, is right after the September 11th attacks on New York and Washington, D.C., Buckingham Palace started playing Star Spangled Banner, which is just an extraordinary thing if you think about the history and what that would actually mean. But it was such an act of solidarity and such an act of knowing exactly what the time would be to show some world leadership through symbols, which is many people dismiss, but is crucially important. And so there's a sense in which the life of the Queen, the death of the Queen, affects people differently. We have listeners all around the world. A lot of them, obviously, are here in North America. And it's fascinating to watch the differences and the similarities. I saw a clip from the BBC, I believe, doing man-on-the-street interviews with people about the Queen. And they had two American tourists in London, I believe, who were just speaking with great reverence about Queen Elizabeth and what she meant to them. And then they interviewed an actual resident of London who kind of went into a critique of the monarchy and that sort of thing. So some of that might have to do with the way that Americans have consumed the crown series, the Queen movie, a great deal of British monarchy sort of content, entertainment content that makes that connection. But I think it's more than that. So let's talk about, first of all, before we talk about kind of what this means for Christians, what did the Queen mean for England as someone who is born and raised in the United Kingdom?
Yes, I think we're learning what she meant to us by having to cope with her absence. She's always been there. I mean, this is the thing everyone has said, is she has been the one point of continuity in our whole lifetimes for the vast majority of us. So she's always represented that sort of unflappable presence, that sort of the baseline grandmother of the nation. So she's always been there in the background. She's always been a sort of reassuring presence. And at certain points, she would speak in almost grandmotherly terms to the nation, not least most recently during the pandemic. She gave an address and it made a difference. So there's lots of things that she's meant to us that aren't dependent on whether we are pro-royalist or not. Even friends of mine who would say that they're not particularly pro-royalist, she still has meant something to them. She's still been a stabilizing presence and a figurehead. I mean, she has been the symbol of our people in a way, I think, that is different to an elected head of state, because an elected head of state is elected only by a portion of the population and is only there for a few years. There's something quite temporary there. They do represent the country. But the Queen embodied our country. And she said once that this was the role she valued the most, she said, was being the symbol of the nation. Mm. And she very much was. She kind of embodied who we are as a people. So irrespective of people's political convictions, ideological convictions, she's meant that for so many people. And I think what we've realized since her passing is how much she meant to us in that regard. I've been listening, like you, to many interviews with lots of people, and just from my own experience as well, people have been very surprised at how emotional they've been. So many friends of mine have said they've been surprised how much they cried. Boris Johnson, our former Prime Minister, gave a really very powerful tribute to her in the House of Commons. And one of the things he said that I thought summed it up was it feels like we've lost a family member. And it really does, actually. It feels akin to losing a grandparent. Someone who was always there that we sort of took for granted. She was always around in the background. And someone who we're very conscious served us so diligently and in such a dedicated way. So I think it's partly the passing of her and who she was. And I think bound up with that as well is it's the end of an era, not just of the Elizabethan age, but of that kind of figurehead, that kind of public servant. It feels like she was the last really great public servant who wasn't seemingly interested in it for herself, but who didn't get a choice, but she chose to embrace a life of public service.
You know, the imagery you just used of grandparent and a few minutes ago of grandmother, I had not thought about this before until you just said that. But it seems to me that's a key part of what's different here, is that there's a kind of, in almost everyone that I know, even people who have very, very difficult relationships with their parents, often there's a grandparent who's able to have a different kind of authority and a different kind of connection. And with Queen Elizabeth, what you saw was someone who not only had this continuity and had been around for almost everyone's entire life from the very beginning, but also had this combination of gravity with levity. I mean, I think of the Paddington Bear tea party, which initially when I saw this, I thought, oh, this is some unauthorized sort of CGI deepfake that one will see. No, she was sort of leading the country with this light kind of moment. It's very hard to have that kind of leadership that's neither aloof and stuffy nor superficial and light. And she seemed to be able to do it.
She did. And by every account, she had an extraordinarily sharp sense of humor, and which she was very sparing in how she used publicly, because again, she's serving in a certain role and she would never want her to seem frivolous, but she apparently was very, very funny. There's been some wonderful stories that have come out. You've probably heard the one about the her security guard was telling the story about when she ran into some tourists in Scotland and they didn't recognize her. They saw her with this her security guard, and they said to her, "Hey, so you're near Balmoral. Have you ever seen the Queen?" And she just immediately pointed to her bodyguard and said, "He sees her often." And it's just things like that, and then they ended up taking a picture of him. And
then she took the picture, didn't she?
She took the picture of all of them, and I think she said, "Do take one with me too," thinking at some point the penny will eventually drop. But and I think that was part of the sort of the reassuring presence, was that she was unflappable. You knew she was on top of things. Every politician and prime minister has said how thoroughly she knew what was going on and fully on top of all the events and all of the sort of things going on in the world today. But she also just carried herself in a way that made you feel like, you know, we don't all have to be panicking the whole time. She sort of conveyed a sense of it, you know, it's going to be okay. So there was something very calming and stabilizing about that.
Contrast that with, you talked about the way that, unlike an elected official, there was this unifying sense and that sense of stability that came with Queen Elizabeth. But then we look at the generations below when it comes to the royal family, and you have, we'll talk about a little bit later about sort of secularization and religion and those questions, but just in terms of tumult. When you have the way that the press, for instance, will, in what seems to me to be really horrible ways, I mean, in obviously horrible ways, when we look at, for instance, the way that Princess Diana died, and then the kind of harassment coming externally, but then also what seems to be often some chaos happening internally with the other generations of the royal family. Is that just kind of family drama we all have in different ways? Or is there something kind of changing in English culture, in world culture, that represents?
It's very interesting, because Charles, obviously, the new king, has had a, you know, I feel for him. He's had such a busy week that the poor man is needing to grieve his mother, but is also having to do all these sort of matters of state. But he's sort of given some early speeches to try to indicate and reassure that he is going to have the same values that his mother did, the same dedication. But it does feel different. I mean, she was 13 at the outbreak of the Second World War, I think, or something like that. She was very young. Mm. I think she was 13. So she was formed during this time of national crisis, and where everyone was required to do their bit, and she did. So she was sort of steeped in that culture of service being one of the highest values. And the culture we live in now, that is not the case. You know, the word duty has come up, I don't know how many times in the last few days, but it's not a word that feels native to who we are now. That kind of felt like that was part of her thing. but it's not really where we're at today. So although Charles is saying, and I'm sure very sincerely, and I'm sure he will serve the country in a very diligent way, that there was something about her generation for whom duty was more important than self-fulfillment, self-expression, all of the things that we tend to sort of zero in on in our own days, and the sort of younger generation of royals in one sense represents that. You've got, you know, Harry, who was feeling torn between his life as a royal, but someone who wanted to do his own thing. And many people would sympathize with that today. So there has been a generational change. She came out of a time where she really did. I mean, she gave that vow on her 21st birthday, saying that she said, "By my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be dedicated to your service." And she was as good as her word on that. But there are very few people who approach public life with that kind of mentality.
Mm-hmm.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I know when we have a really busy week, when we have so many great things to do, but there's something on the calendar every day, my social battery can get totally depleted. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and to spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. And what's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Figuring out what we need on our own can be challenging. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to understand your needs and build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's convenient, flexible, and easily fits into your social calendar. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/RussellMoore today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/RussellMoore.
As an ancestral Baptist, I'm obviously not too keen on kings or queens serving as head of churches, but there are many people who, looking at even just with Westminster Abbey funeral and several of the ways that the country is grieving the loss of the Queen, not to mention her own posture, a kind of English Christianity that doesn't seem to exist anymore. Do you see the dissonance there between those two things?
Very much so. I mean, she was very open about her faith. So we know with her faith, it wasn't merely a kind of a cultural or nominal thing. And that will be, I'm sure, reflected in her funeral. She will have chosen, I'm sure, a lot of the details of what will be sung and said at her funeral. But I can feel there's a gap between that and, again, most people on the street today would not have that same. It's not just that they wouldn't have the same kind of faith in Christ that she had, but those cultural Christian markers are just less common now. That there's much less of a cultural Christianity, and again, I think her passing sort of represents the end of that era too, where Christianity was embraced as being sort of such a key part of public life. Charles, it seems, has faith. He said various things that would indicate he is trusting Christ and has championed particularly the persecuted church in different areas. But again, it feels different. And that's a sense in which, again, culturally, that the royals are a little out of step with many people today.
But in one way, maybe completely in step, just in terms of the transition points that one sees from the Queen, obviously, what we've just talked about, with King Charles, there's a spirituality, but it, at least in his public comments, seems much more pluralistic. Defender of the faiths rather than defender of the faith, he had said at one point earlier. And and more of a very modern sense of the spiritual as at work in multiple places. And then to the third generation, where there's almost no conversation about the conversation that is had about that third generation is largely about things that really have nothing, at least publicly, to do with Christian faith. Does it look as though somehow there's almost a representative of waves of change that are happening in English life, even there?
Yes, that seems to be the case, and time will tell. It's interesting that the Queen, and we'll wait and see what happens with Charles in terms of his public comments, and we obviously don't know his heart, but the Queen seemed unembarrassed to talk about Jesus. Particularly in her Christmas Day speeches, which were very personal. She wrote them herself. This was her message to the nation. She would almost always talk about Jesus and what Jesus meant to her, how he had been such a key sort of part of her life. I can't recall hearing Charles talk about Jesus. I've heard him talk about the importance of faith, and I've heard him talk about God. So it'll be interesting to see if he is as comfortable talking about Jesus publicly as she is, or at least as she was. There were a few years I used to sort of, when Christmas time would come around, I'd slightly roll my eyes, and I often said to people, you know, Christmas time is when the politicians talk about morals and the bishops talk about politics, and it's only the Queen who actually talks about Jesus, which she always would. And we'll see what happens with Charles, and then in due course with William. I'm told that at William and Kate's wedding, they wrote their own intercessions. I know from William's schooling that he has very much heard the gospel. There has been an evangelical presence in his schooling. Where he is with it, we will wait and see. But it's the language these days is much less about belief and more about values, and that seems to be the sort of the main conversation point: is what are the values of Charles going to be? What are the values of William going to be? What are the causes they've been aligning themselves with, and what does that tell them about where they're at? That seems to be more significant to culture than what they believe and what they profess to worship.
You're of course ordained in the Church of England, and one of the interesting things about the Church of England is this always delicate balance between various constituencies within the Church. Not that is a modern sort of factionalism, but that has existed in tension really from the very beginning. And one of the things that I will often here are from Anglican evangelicals. I mean, I might talk to an Anglican evangelical in England who will say, well, the problem is the loss of evangelical witness and biblical authority, and the Church of England is just drifted into a very leftist sort of vision of Christianity, or a very formal kind of cultural understanding, but without the power of the gospel. And then I might talk to a high church Anglican who will say, well, the Church of England is a mess because all of the old parishes are being shut down and all of the attention is going to these evangelical Anglican churches who are having rock music and so forth and all of these innovations and doing church growth strategies that are kind of alien to us. And so you have kind of both groups thinking that the other is in charge. What do you think the future of with these changes that are happening in terms of culture in the United Kingdom and the kind of secularization that's happening throughout Western Europe, and we'll talk about North America in just a minute, what will happen to the church? And by church, I mean specifically the established church, the Church of England.
Yeah, I would love to have some snappy answer to that. I'm really not sure, because as you say, one of the interesting dynamics, and I've heard the very same thing. I've got friends who are part of the General Synod, the governing body of the Church of England. I speak to people who are theologically conservative and people who are theologically progressive. All of them think the other side is winning. All of them are pessimistic. So those who are more progressive and are wanting to see certain sort of formal doctrinal changes and embracing of same-sex marriage, they're nervous and pessimistic, but then so are my conservative friends. So whether that means there's actually a stalemate, I don't know. But on the ground, it does tend to be the evangelical churches that are growing. That has been the case for some time, and we're beginning to see that really affect life in particular dioceses where the diocese is running out of money and it's only the evangelicals who are vaguely solvent. So I think it will come down to finances at some point. A lot of things often do. So it's hard to, at least demographically, it would seem to suggest things are going more in favour of the evangelicals. Lots of churches growing and planting. So we're in a sort of funny situation where it feels like a lot of the hierarchy is dominated by theological liberals, but then in terms of who's actually filling the pews, it tends to be the evangelicals. So there's a tension there. And there will most likely be some kind of split, because the doctrinal differences are irreconcilable. You can't live with that kind of division. And the question would be, what kind of split will emerge? Will it be a North American style issue with the Episcopal Church and ACNA, or will it be a slightly more amicable, agree to go our separate ways, and we'll wait and see. But I can't see it hanging together much longer.
Well, isn't it interesting how many of these splits that are happening, not just in Anglicanism, but United Methodist Church in North America and various other places, over these questions of sexuality, because it is very difficult, if not impossible, to find a via media there. When for one side, those of us who are in the more traditional Christian understanding, it's a matter of biblical authority and we can't do away with that. For people who have a different understanding, it's, well, this is a matter of human rights and marginalization of people. There's just no way to come in and try to navigate through that. So it really does seem almost as though division has to happen in these places.
Yeah, I think so. You know, the 10, 15 years ago now, the introduction of women bishops was an issue that was very divisive. But it wasn't for evangelicals a sort of a first order issue that was sort of a, this is an existential threat to the whole denomination and there are ways of working around it and having alternative oversight and that kind of thing. But you're right, when it comes to our doctrine of marriage and human sexuality, it's impossible to compromise on that. Both sides, it's the one thing, when I was on Synod, it was the one thing me and my more progressive counterparts agreed on was the Church of England has to make a decision one way or the other. They can't keep trying to sort of keep everyone together. It's a gospel issue for us. And both sides think the other side is doing something extraordinarily harmful to people through what they believe. That my progressive friends think I'm harming LGBT people with my theology, and I sincerely believe anything other than the biblical teaching on this is going to be doing eternal harm to people as well. So again, the stakes are so high on this that there will need to be some kind of divergence.
If you were to just walk outside onto the streets of London or Manchester or somewhere else and talk to a group of 22-year-old people there, and you started asking about, what do you think about Jesus? What do you think about the church? I mean, obviously there would be differences, but what would be, do you think, the typical kind of response from that age group in the United Kingdom right now?
Yeah, to the extent that I you know, obviously caveats are plenty to this, but from the conversations I've had, people tend to associate the church now with abuse of power, with moral compromises over the years and cover-ups and all of that kind of thing. But people are still open to talking about Jesus. There are increasing numbers who know next to nothing about Jesus. They may have heard of Jesus and know that he was someone who lived 2,000 years ago, worshipped by Christians, but many may not even know more than that. It's interesting, when I've done university missions in the UK, if I'm doing a series of talks over a few days, almost always I'll do the first talk on the failures of the church. Mm-hmm. Because I want to show that self-awareness to understand that I also see some of the things that the public have seen, and to try to make a distinction between the performance of the church and the claims of Jesus, and actually try and even use our failings as an apologetic for Jesus. But I found that has been a fruitful way of acknowledging where Christianity has not best reflected the teachings of Christ, in a way that actually leads to conversations about Christ. Mm. But increasing ignorance, I think there's less antagonism towards Jesus. I hear very few people actually saying anything negative about him, but I suspect that's as much to do with ignorance of what he says than anything else.
Mm-hmm. You and I were once at a pastor's conference of some kind or the other. And I think about it often, somewhere in the States. And the person on the platform was giving away books to, you know, the oldest people there, the youngest people there, the people who did come the farthest distance. And one of the questions was, when was your church founded? And so you go from, you know, church planters who 6 months or less, and you just keep, they kept going, and you kept standing. Everybody would sit down as their age until finally they said, well, how old is your church? And your church was founded in what? 1002 or 1234, something like this. And I think immediately everyone realized, oh yes, there's quite a difference, even when it comes to chronology between the UK and the USA, when it comes to church life. You have the unique perspective of somebody who has served within the church in the United Kingdom. You're someone who serves our church, Emmanuel Church, Nashville, in the United States, and you're someone who speaks all over the world all the time. I can hardly keep up with where you are on the planet on any given day. What are the differences that you see between evangelical Christians and church life in the United States and in Western Europe and other places in the world?
Yes, there's lots of differences, and these are going to be, you know, generalizations, obviously. I think one of the most significant things I keep coming back to is what for us in the UK has been a gradual process of the culture becoming secular. I mean, we've had sort of decades to come to terms with that and to learn how to live within that and to learn how to reach a culture that is no longer sharing many of our values. In so many parts of the States, that has happened within a decade. Mm-hmm. And so one of the big differences I'm seeing is how to respond to secularism. Mm. Because in the UK, we've had a long time to learn how to respond to it, how to try to understand it, how to try and be fruitful in ministry within that kind of context. I think because it's been such a quick process in so many parts of the US, one of the big responses I'm seeing in so many parts of the church is anger. And so I'm seeing far
is
more
anger.
Than
I,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And a sense of you know, being faithful means having my level of anger at everything that's going on in culture.
Yeah.
Thankfully not across the whole of the US church, but I've seen more of that than I've seen happening in the UK. And so I think that there are lots of things that the UK church can learn from the US. I've always thought the US is better at discipleship and training than we are in the UK. I do wonder whether doing fruitful evangelism in a kind of more post-Christian cultural context is something the UK church has had to have more experience at, and there'll be parts and regions of the US where people have had to do that for many more years as well. But I think that that's one of the key differences is how we respond to a rapidly secularizing culture around us, and how we see that as an opportunity for the gospel, and not just as a sign of we're losing the kind of culture war, but to think, okay, this is a new context for us. Let's see the gospel shine in this kind of setting now.
Ashley here. If you're looking for another podcast that features inspiring conversations with religious leaders, authors, and artists, then I recommend listening to the acclaimed podcast, No Small Endeavor. Produced by Great Feeling Studios and PRX, No Small Endeavor explores what it means to live a good life. Each episode, host Lee C. Camp sits down with special guests, like award-winning journalist and best-selling author Tim Alberta and civil rights hero Reverend James Lawson, to ask what it means to live a life worth living. You can even hear from Russell Moore on No Small Endeavor. If you're looking for somewhere to start, check out their new episode with Malcolm Gladwell, New York Times best-selling author and host of the wildly popular podcast Revisionist History. They explore how Malcolm became a stellar storyteller, some of the things he may or may not regret, and so much more. Don't miss out. Follow No Small Endeavor wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, and the connections between the church in the United Kingdom and the church, meaning capital C church, the actual body of Christ in the United States, the connections have always been so close. I think of speaking one time in London, and one of the things that was on my mind is how indebted I am to C.S. Lewis, whose portrait's right over my head here, and John Stott and J.I. Packer and so many figures that were sort of speaking to me from across the pond and to so many of us. And then when I arrived, the person who was there said, "We know you, we can't, that you don't have anything to do with this and you can't take credit for it, obviously, but we almost want to have someone just to kind of stand in that we can thank for Billy Graham," because he stood up and he said, "How many of you are Christians because of a Billy Graham crusade or because someone close to you came to know Christ at a Billy Graham crusade?" And it was a third to a half of the room. Yeah. So you just think about those very close connections that really aren't, I mean, there is something about cultural contextualization. We do have to do that. But Billy Graham walked right into London with his North Carolina accent and just preached the Bible. And C.S. Lewis was able to write from Oxford with his pipe and with all of his Englishness and reach this kid in Mississippi. I mean, there's something that transcends all of that in its authenticity. And I think it's something really kind of beautiful and ought to maybe cause us to think about how much more often that happens than we think.
It is a beautiful thing. And it's a reminder that, you know, all of us in our particular networks and movements and locations have so much to learn from the wider Christian scene, from Christians from other cultural contexts. I'm sure it's part of how God has designed it. There's meant to be an interdependence between us within the global church. And there are friends of ours who are sort of doing amazing work to resource and help equip churches in parts of the third world. And, you know, as we become more interconnected, I'm looking forward to seeing how shaped and formed we can be by church leaders from the Southern Hemisphere. We've had such a close relationship as the UK and the US that it's not surprising if the special relationship extends into the church as well. But if we can learn that much from each other just across the pond, you've got to wonder how much will we learn from our brothers and sisters in Africa or the emerging churches in China or South America.
Well, as the Archbishop of Canterbury said about Anglicanism, that the typical Anglican right now is a, I think he said, a 32-year-old woman in Nairobi.
Yeah.
Not someone in London or Cambridge. And that's really having all sorts of implications for good. Yeah. In multiple ways, really, all around the world.
Absolutely. And I think it was Rebecca McLaughlin in her book, Confronting Christianity, who made the point that when people are insulting evangelicals, they don't realize that most of the people they're insulting are African. Mm-hmm. The image, cultural image of the evangelical may be the older white guy in the mm-hmm. US, but the reality is the evangelical, as you say, is younger, female, and most likely African.
I had our mutual friend, Tim Keller, with me to a group of completely secular students in the United States, most of whom had never met an evangelical Christian before. And during the question and answer time, someone said, why do the two of you even keep the evangelical language when it has become so tarnished and for obvious reasons? And I will never forget, Tim's response was to say, because most of us are in Asia and Africa and Latin America, and the North Americans don't get to choose what we're called because we may have messed up the word. And it was really striking to me because I watched, and those students just sort of nodded their heads and said, fair enough. But the most striking thing to me was not the way he kind of turned the question around. It was the fact that he said, most of us are in Africa and Asia and Latin America. And I think if we can get that, something will be really bright about the future.
Absolutely.
What gives you hope, Sam Albury, as you look around?
What gives me hope is Christ will build his church. Mm-hmm. Christ is building his church. Of the increase and of his government and of peace, there will be no end. And we see that around us. There are always, whatever else is going on in culture that may cause us dismay, there are always the green shoots of gospel life coming through. You get to move around the country a fair bit too, and seeing so many wonderful younger pastors, wonderful ministries, wonderful church plants, and then seeing what is going on in other parts of the world, it's humbling, but it's very inspiring too. There is just some very, God has raised up some wonderfully godly, able, humble leaders right across the world who are just serving faithfully.
Mm. Thank you, Sam Albury, for being with us today on the Russell Moore Show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave a review there. Really helps people to find the show if you leave a review. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap the cover art and you'll find show notes with some resources for you. And you can send this along to a friend who might be interested in some of these topics. While you're there, check out Christianity Today, founded by Billy Graham, with all kinds of resources for you in understanding the world around you and in advancing and carrying out the mission of Christ. This is Russell Moore, and you're listening to the Christianity Today's Russell Moore Show.
The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Eric Petrick is our Chief Creative Officer. Russell Moore is the executive producer and our host. Mike Cosper is our director of podcasts. Administration for CT by Christine Kolb and Abby Perry. Production assistance by Core Media. Beth Grabencourt, coordinator. Kevin Duthu, producer and sound mixer. Our theme song is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hutton. If you like what you heard today, please consider subscribing so you don't miss any future episodes.